You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Welcome, everybody, and thanks to everybody for coming out this morning. You know, thanks to all the millennials for showing up at what is, I understand, a very early hour for you. I'm Bill Galston, a senior fellow in governance studies here at Brookings, and I have to say it gives me particular pleasure to welcome, representatives of, indeed, a substantial portion of the Center for Information and Research at Civic Learning and Engagement, CIRCLE for short, founded at the University of Maryland, now at Tufts. You'll be hearing from Al Solomon, Dean of Tufts, at the end of this program. At any rate, it gives me particular pleasure to tee up this conversation and presentation about the young adult vote in the 2016 election. There are lots of myths and rumors about the young adult vote floating around, but in the 15 years since it was founded, CIRCLE has become the go-to organization nationally for the most accurate and penetrating research and analysis on the young adult vote. And so you are about to see all the myths dispelled, the rumors dispatched. You are about to learn what young adults actually did in this election, and on that basis, we can have a rich conversation, perhaps, as to why they did it. The order of events is very straightforward. Kei Kawashima Ginsberg and Abby Keiza will lead off with a PowerPoint presentation summarizing the results of the research that CIRCLE has done post-election to understand the young adult vote. There'll be a panel discussion led off by a couple of highly appropriate commentators. I will then turn to the audience for a moderated Q&A, and at the end, Dean Solomon will offer some reflections on what has transpired in the preceding hour and a half. The biographies of all of the people who will be making presentations are in your packet. I'm not going to waste your time or theirs by reading what you can read for yourselves, but let me say it is a real pleasure to be able to welcome CIRCLE to Brookings. I hope it's not the last time, and to begin to learn from this organization about what is the future of American politics, namely young adults. So without any further ado, Kay, Abby, floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dr. Galston. Back in 2000, way back in 2000, there was a hunger for data to help illuminate how to engage young people further in civic and political life. Thanks to Dr. Galston, CIRCLE's founding director, Peter Levine, CIRCLE's founding deputy director and second director, and many others, CIRCLE was founded to help facilitate this effort with a foundational commitment to dialogue between research, policy, and practice. We're thrilled to be here today to continue that commitment. Since 2008, CIRCLE has been part of the Jonathan M. Tisch College of Civic Life at Tufts University. The Tisch College of Civic Life is a full college on the Tufts campus and has a dean who's with us here today. But we don't have degree programs because the philosophy of the college is that the staff of the college work with all of the other colleges at Tufts, including the dental school, medical school, and others, to embed civic education into all of the curriculum of the school. CIRCLE's mission continues to be about using many forms of research to inform efforts to increase and strengthen young people's opportunities to learn to advance civic and political life. While much has changed since 2001, this work is still needed. We want our research to be informed by what's happening with policy and practice. And as a result, our research helps to strengthen policy practice for both a stronger civic life and healthier youth development. We do this through these three strategies. And while our lever remains solidly in research and conversations with policy and practice, our analyses increasingly focus on using research to advance equity and quality of civic efforts. How does this connect to 2016? Why continue to talk about youth in 2016? Well, there's many meaningful reasons to talk about youth and political life, including Black Lives Matter efforts that have been led by youth, largely young women, the economic reality that youth have emerged into in the, over the past 10 years. There's been a surge of youth activism well before the election started. Millennials are more passionate about doing something where they can have an impact, like community engagement, which is an ongoing conversation. Social media, of course, has become an incredible and nimble tool that helps young people amplify voices and organize around issues that they care about. Social enterprise is also something that we're seeing, and I know all of you are seeing, as particularly consistent with this generation's desire to work around the system rather than working sometimes within the system. Specifically related to electoral politics, many young people are not happy with the presidential election results and are making their voice heard about it. As we'll explain, youth as a whole didn't vote for the president-elect and were critical to keeping the race competitive as they did in 2012. Additionally, after the 2012 election, the Republican Party took time to conduct their own autopsy, so to speak, and it's worth looking at how they did among youth this cycle. In fact, not all youth voted for Secretary Clinton, and a substantial slice of the youth electorate voted for President-elect Trump. Today, we'll present what we know so far about youth and federal races from a variety of sources, though this is a slice of the data and more will come over the next several months to illuminate more, including about more youth subgroups that we won't talk about today. We also know that young people are engaged in elections at the state and local level, which are absolutely critical and many believe is an area of significant potential.
Thank you, Evie, and thank you again for being here. My name is Kay Kalshima-Ginsberg. I'm the director of CIRCLE. I will be talking a little bit about the overall picture of what youth vote looked like in 2016. So let's take a broad look first. At the end of the day, young people voted at about the same rate as they did in 2012. We estimate about 50% of young people voted. That translates to about 24 million young people. And with that 24 million young people, they voted for Hillary Clinton by a large margin of 57% compared to 34%, and about 9% voted for other candidates such as Johnson, Stein, and others. Now, when we talk about young people's voting, they did overwhelmingly favor Hillary Clinton like they did in 2008 and 12, but I put this graph here to put that in a historical context, which is that young people didn't always prefer Democratic candidate in presidential race all the time. In fact, during the Reagan year and in Bush senior year, they actually preferred a Republican candidate, as you can see. So in the historical context, this was another year when young people overwhelmingly favored the Democratic candidate. Now, as Ophim say, though, there are many narratives about young voters. This is simply an average of how young people voted. And when we started to dissect the youth vote after we got the exit poll data, and also before we knew from pre-election poll, there are many stories of young people, and they have different realities, different priorities, and how they voted really reflected that particular kind of divide that we have. Here's what we knew before the election, which was that the young people, just like older generations, were polarized in some ways. For example, they were divided on the trust in key institutions such as police, president, and military. If you look at the graph here, the 63% of young white people trusted the police, at least to a certain extent, whereas only 23% of African American youth said that they could believe and trust the police. They were also divided in what they thought the priority of the country was. When we surveyed the young people before the election, 35% of young people who were already supporting Clinton, whether they were actually going to vote or not, said that they thought that the violence against people of color was one of the most important things that next president needs to address, compared to just 17%. So the priorities are already very different for different young people. Now, we already know from the previous research, and this is pretty well-known fact, that young people are, in fact, much more diverse. And this was reflected in the 2016 electorate. So this is a makeup of the voters by age. And this pie on the young people actually reflects really closely what young people look like as citizen population. What that means, though, is that within the youth electorate, youth of color really matters. It's a really big slice of the pie compared to what it looks like for older adults. So I'm going to talk about the story of youth of color first. Exit poll shows that the African-American youth, Latinos, and youth of color in general overwhelmingly favored Hillary Clinton. More than half of her votes actually came from youth of color, about 53%, with the biggest group of her supporters coming from youth of color without college degree. Now, why did they really vote for her, right? Before the election, we found that the youth of color overwhelmingly supported her, and the what they thought was really important really mattered. When it came to voting on the election day, overwhelming majority of young people of supporters of Hillary Clinton thought that the African Americans were biased, or they were biased against African Americans in criminal justice system. And that really explains why youth of color supported Hillary Clinton in large numbers, but also white allies who really felt that this was an important issue. And although before the election, some of the Clinton supporters were expressing mixed emotions about Hillary Clinton, at the end of the day, this is the candidate they chose in order to address this very important priority for young people. Also, youth of color, and especially young women of color, remain the biggest and most consistent supporting group of Hillary Clinton and Democratic Party in general. Young black women, for example, was the biggest and most consistent supporter of Hillary Clinton among all groups. 94% of young women who's African American voted for her. Now, there was a lot of conversation about the needed change that needed to come to this country, and that's actually why young people voted for Barack Obama in 2008. And if anybody was about change, that was Donald Trump. So why didn't majority of young people vote for him rather than her? A lot of young people expressed fear about having somebody like Donald Trump as a president. 67% of black youth and 36% of Latino youth said that they would be scared if Mr. Trump was to be elected president. And 84% and 57% of black and Latino youth respectively said that they would be excited if president was Hillary Clinton instead. So this fear was a big driver of why they chose Hillary Clinton. And it wasn't just concern to know, it was the fear. And if you combine the people that are African-American that were concerned or scared of Donald Trump presidency, that would be almost all of the black youth. And that's something to really think about moving forward. Now, the pre-election split support between candidates really meant a lot. At the end of the day, when white voters came to vote, it was really surprising to many young people and older adults in that the white youth as a whole supported and favored Donald Trump at 48% to 43%. Now, this really tells only part of the story because there was a big divide among young people who are white. This was a divide by gender, really. So young white women preferred Clinton over Trump 50% to 42%, while young white men favored Mr. Trump by almost 20 points, 54 to 35%. This was also the first election we've seen in a while where young white men's turnout may have actually been higher than young white women's. In the previous elections, young white women had well more than half of the share of young white votes. This year, it was the other way around. 52% was cast by white men, and then 48% was cast by white women. This is the first time we've seen that. And in our estimate, we've seen about 600, maybe a million or so more votes cast more than by young white men, more than 2012 this year. We also knew from the pre-election poll that men and women had very different kind of experience with campaign contact. The middle of the graph shows that the millennial men and women who were contacted and when they're not affiliated with any party. And once again, this is about half of the young people, and this is an increasing trend. But when you look at that particular group by gender, you can see that men were twice as likely to be reached out by campaign than women from that same category. So now we'll move forward with talking about the Trump supporters. Again, as a reminder, about one-third of young voters who came out to vote supported Donald Trump. This was actually more than what we had seen in the pre-election poll, in where we were seeing about 20-25% of young people in general saying that they would support Donald Trump. And we'll dive into why that may have been. But first, let's look at who they were. So the Donald Trump's voters were 80% white and predominantly male, about 59% were male. And largest share of his support came from young white people without college degrees. So that was about 32%. And this is in contrast with the 35% of young people who contributed to Clinton, who were young people of color without college degree. So the demographic of the voters for each candidate was very different. And in terms of their political identification, 62% were Republican and 31% were independent and other. And when compared to the Clinton supporters, the Trump supporters were more rural. They're more likely to be evangelical Christian. They were more likely to attend religious services at least weekly. And they were extremely dissatisfied with the state of this country. 88% of young Trump supporters said the country was on the wrong track. 27% was flat out angry at the government, compared to just 9% among Clinton supporters. And 61% supported the building of the wall between the U.S. and Mexico border. And about a quarter actually questioned the legitimacy of their own votes. They're worried that their votes wouldn't be counted. And finally, they expressed a deep mistrust of Secretary Clinton. 3% thought that she's honest, and 93% were bothered by the email allegations that she dealt with toward the end of her campaign. We also saw that, you know, like I said, there were fewer Trump supporters in our pre-election poll, but it actually made sense that more of those young people voted. It came to election day. What we saw was that the Trump supporters were small base, but they were more enthusiastic and excited before the election. This graph shows that, you know, slightly more of the Trump supporters use two positive words to describe their feelings about their candidate of choice. And they were also more likely to say excited. So 32% of Trump supporters said they were excited about the candidate's choice as compared to the 18% of Clinton supporters. So let me see. Okay. So let me talk about who actually voted. There was ways in which the electorate was diverse. And as I said, the racial representation of electorate was quite representative of the national population. What didn't happen, though, was the educational attainment representation. When we look at the youth population as a whole, what we find is that about 40% of young people have no college experience at all. But here's what we saw, which is that about 19%, as opposed to 40% in the general population, were young voters without college experience. And as you can see, the proportion of this particular group shrank over this last election. It had been steadily around 30%. This time around, we saw just 19%. And by the way, when we looked at the election, educational attainment by the, you know, Trump and Clinton supporters, which I did show a little bit earlier in the slide, we didn't find any evidence that the Trump supporters were significantly less educated in that way. They were just as likely to have gone to the college. However, Clinton supporters were more likely to have completed college. So it was a little bit more complicated than saying the Trump supporters were uneducated. They were likely the true middle class. They were the people that had perhaps gone and done some higher education but didn't quite finish the four-year degree. So that's really who voted and what happened here. Now, it's really an irony that the electorate that was really about the working class and bringing up the people that had no voice prior to this election ended up becoming more elite this time around. It really has implications on how we reach out to different kinds of young people and who we think would vote, and as a result, include in the electorate moving forward. With that, I'm going to ask Abby to talk about institutions.
As many of you know, CIRCLE's work is quite broad, focusing on a broad definition of civic engagement. So election work is one slice of what we do. And as a result, we're thinking about civic institutions quite a lot. So what I wanted to talk about is the context of this voting, the historical context, as well as the 2016 context of parties as civic institutions. So in our view, parties serve several functions in civic and political life, in addition to being core elements of how elections are organized. And young people, for several years now, as many of you know, have been less favorable to affiliating with the two major political parties. Each party has a small base that's committed, but not an extremely wide appeal. Young people who cast ballots in 2016 were more likely to identify as liberal than in recent elections. And you can see that here in this graph, 32% in 2008, 37% in 2016. But they were less likely to identify as Democrats, 45% in 2008, 37% in 2016. This shift suggests that young people increasingly embrace a liberal ideology, but do not necessarily see the Democratic Party as an institution that can represent and advance those ideas. Alternatively, young voters who identified as Democrats when they cast ballots in 2008 and 2012 may have been drawn to the party and the voting booth in the inspiring candidacy of now President Barack Obama, but may not be otherwise committed to the party and perhaps decided not to vote in 2016. One exception to this that I want to specifically point out and that Kay has otherwise, is that young Black women and young Latinas, a majority of whom identify with the Democratic Party, which raises many questions about what the party will do in the future, if anything, to meet them where they are. Among self-identified young Democrats, some youth chose to vote for a third party candidate, as you can see in this graph here. In his two elections, President Obama drew support from well over half of young people who saw themselves as neither liberal nor conservative. This year, while moderate women backed Secretary Clinton, moderate men did not to the same degree, and she lost white moderates overall. These young people who eschew the political extremes are likely to continue to play decisive roles in the election to come, given the size of the group. And here's what we see over time when it comes to young moderates by gender. On the other hand, Republican-affiliated youth were overrepresented in the 2016 electorate based on our estimates. Large pre-election surveys like the Gens Forward survey and Pew Research's work showed that young people in the general population identify as Republican are between 16 and 22%. However, among all youth who cast ballots this year, 28% identified as Republican. Our own pre-election poll, in which 25% of millennials identified as registered Republicans, points to one possible explanation, which Kay has alluded to, which is that young supporters of Mr. Trump, our president-elect, in our survey reported being more energized and therefore more likely to turn out. Yet, we don't see growth. The GOP, in terms of young people who are affiliating with it in the electorate, is staying relatively static. And in some ways, based on our analysis of some Pew Research political typology data, is misaligned on the big issues like social issues and deportation of immigrants. Only about a third of young voters hold a favorable view of the Republican Party. And part of what is going to face the Republican Party is what to do with the young people who voted for Trump, who we see, based on our pre-election poll, as being politically disconnected previously because of their inexperience with political engagement prior to this election. So it's a it's a question of supporting their development as citizens and ability to address problems they see in their own context using democratic means. In this election, the GOP faced an additional challenge, some young Republicans' aversion to their own party's nominee. Among young people who affiliated as Republican, 39% of women felt that Mr. Trump was not qualified to serve as president, and they were more likely than young Republican men to say that they would be scared if he was elected. Additionally, 37% of young Republican women were bothered a lot by Mr. Trump's rhetoric about women, likely due in part to this discomfort. Almost a quarter of young Republican women voted for another candidate for president, and according to our analysis, may have voted differently down ballot for House of Representatives as a result. This trend was even stronger for women who identify as moderate or people who identify as liberal Republicans, who make up 11% of all young women voters. Part of the frustration among youth regarding political parties is related to some young people's curiosity about third parties. In our pre-election poll, 17% supported Gary Johnson. The national exit poll, however, captured only 8% of youth who supported a third party candidate or chose not to vote in the presidential election. As a result, young people didn't flock to third parties. And finally, while young people split their ticket more than voters over 30, it still did not occur en masse. Among youth, just over three quarters voted for a Senate and presidential candidate of the same party, while 82% of voters over 30 did so. Only 80% of young moderate and liberal Republican women voted for House GOP candidates, compared to 89% of young men and their young male peers. Additionally, 19% of young people who voted for a House GOP candidate did not vote for Trump, and 11% voted for Secretary Clinton. Well, this might not be surprising given the political culture right now. It raises questions for those who see civic institutions as important for building and sustaining engagement. Parties do clearly play a role as core political institutions and in the larger ecosystem, if you will, of civic life. However, nodes of civic life are changing, so it raises questions about what parties do. This reinforces the necessity to develop and support broad-based strategies to grow young people's civic skills and attachment to civic and political organizations. We can't be satisfied with episodic, every 4 years, year cycles of engagement. Research suggests it needs to be about more enduring identity development.
Thank you, Effie. And to conclude a little bit, so in this stormy election cycle that began with youths who were skeptical of voting, but inspired them by candidates that brought the potential of political sea change, you know, showed that strong participation is still the part of youth electorate. While backing Secretary Clinton by a large margin, they also showed that they were politically as well as racially diverse. Now, we're seeing many young people, including those who are not even eligible to vote at that time, take to the street in protest of President-elect Trump. And we're seeing mixed reaction by adults, from strong support for their views and activism to sharp criticism and even worse, dismissal of their voices. How we respond during and after student protests and marches says a lot about how we are, as a society, invest in developing engaged citizens. If we think that young people can and need to learn the skills for effective civic participation, we support skill development through strong civic education and mentorship both in and out of school. We send a message that young people matter and should and can participate. If we act as though youth should be controlled and dismiss their voices, then we communicate that we don't value their voices and their potential to contribute to our civic life now and are in the future. is not there, and we would have really missed a big opportunity in this unique election. We need an electorate that is deeply informed and committed for greater good in the years to come. The first step, then, is achieving that goal, is to support this generation of young people as they process the outcome of this election and make sure they have a voice and influence when they are ready to offer ideas and solutions. We also need to remember that about one-third of young people voted for President-elect Trump and looking for major change. That's why they came out to vote. They were unhappy with the way things were in this country and angry at the government. At least some of these young people, though, according to what we know from previous research, were politically alienated. They were the kind of young people who were never engaged before this election. Then it's on us to make sure we take their voice of dissent to the current system and make sure they can engage in a productive and democratic manner moving forward. They will soon remember that citizens are the ones that make the needed change, not the president. We need to really support their development as they gain their political voice. Even with all these opportunities, though, there are obvious challenges. Findings clearly point to the fact that this election revealed many divides that were not visible, and especially for the millennials, the most progressive generation today. They are, in fact, polarized often by their backgrounds. While it's important to express our voices, we have to help young people go beyond that by helping them to develop and implement solutions that come from diverse perspectives and political ideologies and participate in governance so they can work from within as well as from the outside. Civic education in K-12 schools as well as colleges and in workplaces and civic and political organizations are all essential avenues in which we can help mend the civic fabric of our country. Mending our civic fabric is not a luxury, it's necessity, and I hope we all are ready to contribute. With that, I'd like to welcome back Dr. Bill Galston to the stage, as well as Carmen Barkley and Jane Coaston, our renowned panelists. So please have a seat. Thank you for your attention.
Well, we are on a tight schedule with a lot to pack into an hour and a half, and so I will introduce our two commentators, Carmen Barkley and Jane Coaston, each of whom has 5 minutes for a commentary. There'll be then some crosstalk until 11 o'clock and then 25 minutes for audience Q&A, and at 11:25 I will call Dean Solomon to the podium. So without further ado, Carmen.
Hi. Oh, great. Hi. like a true millennial, I'm doing too much. I'm on Twitter. I'm texting. I'm looking at my notes. So I get the chance to straddle multiple worlds. You know, I'm the civil, human, and women's rights director at the AFL-CIO, which is a federation of unions, but I'm also a regular black woman that participates in things like protests and the Movement for Black Lives and Black Youth Project 100. So I don't necessarily just come to you as a labor activist. I'm coming to you as a young black person that participated in this election, but also very much so identifies with a lot of the research and the methodology that we just saw. How many of you remember when the Movement for Black Lives and the immigrants' rights community shut down Netroots Nation in 2015? That's when Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley got embarrassed at the Netroots Nation. Raise your hand high. Okay, so that was sign number one that millennials were not going to be playing around in this election cycle. And what happened, for those of you that don't remember, is, you know, the Netroots Nation conference, which was in Arizona, basically, you know, even though they were in Arizona, which there's a high population of Latinos, there were a ton of African Americans that said they wanted to be engaged in this election cycle, felt like the conference, felt like the city was not fully embracing communities of color. And so at the conference, that was a conference that I participated in, people from Movement for Black Lives and the immigrants' rights community staged an action against Bernie Sanders and against Martin O'Malley at the conference. But really, what that sign was saying is, you all want for us to participate in elections, and you all want for us to believe in the political process, and yet we cannot indict police officers who kill children. So that was sign number one. I think that's sign number two, you know, fast forwarding to the Netroots Nation conference, because this is our big progressive conference that we have every summer. You literally had young people saying, I'm probably not going to vote in this election. And if I do, I will probably be voting for Jill Stein. So for me, what I heard this entire cycle were young people, particularly young people of color, saying out loud, I do not believe in the political process. I don't know how I feel about the Democratic Party. And yet our progressive movement kind of ignored that a little bit. Young people were saying, we don't know, and we didn't really figure out what are the tactics and the tools to get young people to participate. Because let's face it. It's not that young people don't care about issues. We passed marijuana in two states. There were a number of ballot initiatives that young people cared about that passed. So it's not to say that young people didn't turn out. It was that young people are not motivated by candidates. And so for us as progressives, we've got to figure out how are we going to move outside of, you know, the charismatic candidate and figure out when young people say, I care about criminal justice reform, I care about immigration, I care about my right to choose, how are we connecting candidates to the issues that young people truly care about? But, you know, for me, I'm not here to blame Secretary Clinton or the Democratic Party or even blame progressives. What I'm here to do is to talk to you about what are the three things that we can do moving forward to get us to a place where we can actually all work together. Because people are, they're already moving to 2018. And I'm like, whoa, you're moving to 2018 and we're still in 2016. So how are we going to actually talk to young people about what we can do between now and like next week? Because people are frustrated and they are suffering and they are now really feeling like the political process is not working for me. So number one, we have to be more serious about communities of color being in the leadership development pipeline. So I come from the youth world. I ran the United States Student Association. I ran the Generational Alliance. I come from a long line of young people of color and women of color and queer youth that have empowered each other. If you are a group of white people that work in an institution and you're talking about race, racism, and gender, LGBTQ issues, and there are none of us sitting at the table, you're already doing it wrong. If you do not have young people 31 years old like me that are helping you make budget decisions, helping you make decisions about how you move your strategy forward, because let's face it, we're about to go into a time when women are going to be attacked, people of color are going to be attacked, and queer people are going to be attacked. So if our progressive organizations are not still being run by people of color, you've got a huge problem on your hands. And you've got to think about how are you going to engage differently. The second thing is we have to resource youth organizations to build their capacity in between election cycles. So when I worked at the United States Student Association, we were a multi-million dollar organization in 2008 and 2006 and 2004. But in 2007, we were scraping the barrels to try to find resources. Now, luckily, we had a 501c3, right? So we were able to fundraise foundation money. But as it pertained to our C4, which actually allowed for us to have power, it was so difficult for us to fundraise money. If you want for young people to be able to run your tactics in 2018, then how are we investing in their development and their ability to run tactics in 2017? And resources is not just about money. It's about making sure that they have the skills and making sure that they have the folks around them to be able to build the power that they need to run in election cycles. Because the tactic of door knocking and phone banking, it's not just a siloed to election cycles. The final thing I'll say is this, messaging and media. So at the AFL-CIO, I said to folks, you all are not organizing in the black media. If you're not on Roland Martin, if you're not in Essence Magazine, if you haven't figured out how to get into Color Lines or The Root, then you're actually not talking to black people. Young black people are not reading the New York Times. Okay? When I go home and I talk to my family about what they're not reading the Washington Post. I'm sorry to tell you. Same thing with young Latinos, same thing with young Asians, same thing with young whites. They're reading inside of their media. So if we haven't figured out a way to build a relationship with the media that young people actually care about, like People Magazine, like In Touch, okay, like actually being on MTV networks and our organizations investing in advertising in places where millennials are, then we are just talking to ourselves. So in this cycle, the AFL-CIO, we invested in going around and participating in concerts around the country because that's where young people were. I went to the Beyonce concert twice. But if we're not standing outside of the Beyonce concert trying to register the thousands of people to vote that you know are going to the concert and doing GOTV in places where you know young people are, then you're missing the mark. If we continue to try to phone bank people who don't have house phones anyway, we will continue to lose our strategy. So those are my reflections and my analysis of the 2016 election and what we can do moving forward.
Please, Jane.
Hello, my name is Jane Coast, and I'm a reporter for MTV News. And I think I'd like to start by asking a question. How many of you here are actually born and raised in DC? Okay. How many of you here were born and raised in a East Coast or West Coast state? Okay. How many of you were born and raised in the Midwest? Hello, my people. I was born and raised in Cincinnati, Ohio. I lived in Michigan, and I lived in Missouri. Those are three states, as if you all remember from last week, that Secretary Clinton did not win. And I'm here to talk right now about the issues that I'm seeing from as someone who has written a lot about the right and written a lot about the GOP, some of the issues that we're seeing reflected here, because I think it's something that we can actually talk about in cross currents about what you were just discussing. So as we saw on the data, young Republicans were overrepresented in the 2016 election. And a lot of them, we found, were looking for change. They thought this was a change election, just as much in some ways, but in very different ways, as in 2008, when I remember I was a senior in college, some people thought that the election of President Obama was a change election. The question then is, what kind of change? What change were they looking for? And I think that that's something that is really worthy of discussion. We saw from young Trump voters that more than 80% believe that the United States is on the wrong track. We saw that for many people that they were still averse to their candidate, especially young Republican women, but they still voted anyway and were more likely to vote, especially young white voters and young white moderates. Which is an interesting question. I'm really not sure if we've decided what moderate means, but I think that that's something worth looking into. So I want to talk a little bit about the change that young people, especially in the states, you know, if you're from Michigan, if you're from Ohio, if you're from a lot of the states that some of us are from, what kind of changes are young people looking for? We're talking a lot about the economy. We're talking a lot about jobs. We saw in the data that more people voted, young people voted in this election who had attended at least some college or were college graduates than in previous elections. So that means that there were more young white people and more young people in general who were on college campuses and yet still thought of Trump as being a change candidate. What does that mean? What does that tell us? Personally, I think that that tells us that young people don't exist in vacuums. I think a lot of times when we're talking about young millennials, we think of the young millennials who look like some of the young people in this room. That's not always true. When we're talking about young people, we're talking about young people who are also perhaps evangelical Christians. We're talking about young people who are also the children of people who have maybe, you know, lost jobs that are likely to not never come back, especially in manufacturing or in other industries. So when we're talking about young people, let's focus on the fact that young people are not young people first. You know, I am not just 29 years old. You are not just 31 years old. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about those cross currents. And let's talk about what people saw in Donald Trump was something that, you know, we've heard a lot about, they wanted change. What kind of change did they want? It's interesting because I think that a lot of people were looking at this election as kind of, you know, make America great again, something hearkening backwards. But I think that for a lot of young Republican voters, they were looking for something, interestingly, that might in some ways be kind of recalcitrant, but also looking forwards. Let's remember that part of Trump's strategy was talking about over $1 trillion in infrastructure investment. that towards the latter days of the election, Trump started talking about making college affordable and started talking about, you know, ensuring that everyone could get jobs and ensuring that young people always had access to health care. That's not, you know, I've been following the GOP for a very long time. That's not standard GOP language. And that could be why Trump and Paul Ryan will be in an uncomfortable do-si-do for the next 4 years. But I think that let's talk about those issues, because young people clearly were interested, or especially young Republicans who, in general, they weren't looking for kind of the limited small government that we hear so much about when we're talking about, you know, Russell Kirk and kind of old school Republicans. They were looking for change, but they weren't looking for Republican style change. They were looking for Trump style change. The problem is that Trump style change could put my life and the lives of millions of other people at incredible risk. But for a lot of people, young people who are, you know, we're talking to, you know, their media is just as siloed in some ways as ours. Their media, unfortunately, you know, they're not reading the Washington Post or the New York Times. They're reading Facebook. Mm-hmm. And they're reading Facebook from the same people who are their friends and families, who are often people who look just like them. That's concerning in a lot of ways. I've argued a bunch of times during this election that what we're seeing now is really the after effects of residential segregation. And what I mean by that is that a lot of, you know, think about where you grew up. For a lot of people living in the Midwest, and a lot of people living even in coastal areas, you probably grew up on a street around people who looked a lot like you. You went to school with people who looked a lot like you, and you were friends with people who looked a lot like you. And for many of us, that didn't change until we went to college or until afterwards. That's the same for a lot of the young Republican voters we're seeing now, who, when they hear about, you know, concerns about what Trump's rhetoric and Trump's fan base means, that doesn't mean anything to them, because all their interpretation of it is like, well, I don't know any Muslims. I don't really know that many black people. So when you don't know someone, or you're not surrounded by that group, or those stories are not as personal to you as your personal story of, you know, my dad lost his job 10 years ago and we've never really been able to get back on our feet. Oh, this, you know, this manufacturing plant where my grandma and my grandpa used to work is closed and it's moved to Mexico and Trump told us he can get it back. That's going to be a lot more appealing to you than hearing about a group of people that you don't know personally. So I think that when we're talking about young millennial voters, let's remember that we're not talking about young millennials as in, you know, people on their phones all the time. We're talking about young people who are growing up in states like Iowa, growing up in Arkansas, which also just passed medical marijuana. We're talking about, you know, young people in Wisconsin and Minnesota, not in Milwaukee, not in Madison, but in those small towns where they're surrounded by the same people that, you know, look like their family and look like their friends. So I think that when we're having conversations about why the decisions were made, for those young people, it was a change election, but it also was a stay the same election. Not so much because they want to kind of value kind of the divisiveness and outright racism we saw from the Trump campaign, but because where they are has been the same for the past 30 to 40 years. There hasn't been an influx of minorities or immigrants. There haven't been kind of the widespread changes we've seen. They may never have met a queer person except for watching The Ellen Show. And that's real life for a lot of people. So I think that, you know, when we're talking about young millennial voters who voted for Trump, let's remember that it's not necessarily young millennial voters who voted for Trump who are living in Brooklyn or living in LA. We're talking about people for whom life has been very much the same for the past 20, 30 years. And when they heard about Trump, they heard someone saying, I'm going to build the roads and get the factories back, not I'm going to extreme vet Muslims, a population for many of these people they may never have met. So I think that really thinking about the cross currents of who these voters are is really important, because as I said, you know, they're not just young millennials. They're young millennials, they're young Christians, they're young Republicans or young moderates, and for some, they were young independent voters. And I think that those decisions and how we reach them, that's what's going to be really important to discuss.
That's just fabulous. I don't know about you, but I've learned a whole lot in the past 55 minutes. Brookings should have more panels like this. And we're running considerably behind, so I'm going to throw away my playbook and give the two circle representatives an opportunity to reflect on the reflections that they've just heard, and then I'm going to scrap all of the questions I had prepared and go straight to Q&A from the floor. So, you know, Abby, Kay, you know, want to reflect on what you just heard?
Thank you. I learned a lot, too, in the last 55 minutes. And thank you so much, Carmen and Jane. It's really important to have the perspective really representing the multiplicity of the identity that young people carry, as well as older folks like us. But at the same time, it's really important to remember that young people are really keenly aware of the multiple identities they carry. And I've been really concerned about sort of what we saw in the data in terms of really how actually more close the electorate became and how divided the electorate became. But with you guys' explanation of why those complex identity plays a role and how the change means different things for younger Republicans and conservatives than perhaps older Republicans, conservatives who actually remember the olden days, and young millennials who are voting conservatively don't actually have that vision. And we do have to, as I said in the conclusion, really try to appreciate and value and empathize with the young conservative and Republican voters who, to some of our surprise, supported Donald Trump president-elect, and really find ways in which we can really include these young people as legitimate voice in the politics and American democracy of tomorrow. So I'll stop there.
I wanted to jump in. One of the things that we try to pay attention to a lot, but that's clearly very difficult to measure, is this idea of cultural organizing that has been so prominent among millennial groups. And I guess I was just wondering, I know, Carmen, you alluded to this, but I'm wondering whether or not, you know, both or one of you could speak to how you felt like these campaigns really tapped into the potential of cultural organizing among young people and millennials on both sides, and whether or not you could see that happening in future cycles.
Well, at least for me, you know, I know that Secretary Clinton really tapped into celebrities, and, you know, she was working with Beyonce and working with Katy Perry. But I think that what that showed is, I mean, that's cool, but it's not necessarily, it didn't galvanize in the same way that when President Obama had the same type of celebrity star power. And so I think that there actually has to, we have to marry the actual hard tactics a little bit closer with using celebrities and cultural organizing. But I will say this. How we talk to not just young people, but everyone. I mean, we are totally consumed by what's happening on the internet. We're totally consumed by what's happening on television. And so I think that figuring out when we run tactics, what is the, you know, when we run a cultural tactic, such as having a concert. So I'll give you an example. A week before the election, we were in Miami and we threw a concert. And a lot of people said, why do you have this concert? You know, this isn't something that people are going to come to. 6,000 young black people at a historically black college came to see Pusha T, Gucci Mane.